Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I've read it.
Yes.
Well, okay. Now can you hear me, Brother Imam?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
Okay, we were on speaker, and I'm trying to, all right, until my phone warms up, we'll do this. Yes, I thank you, Brother Imam, for you coming on. I want to introduce to the audience and present to others that Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam is a practicing attorney. I reiterate that, practicing attorney, who not long ago was a law professor, and he taught several years at Syracuse University College of Law, and I believe at the Thurgood Marshall School of Law at the Texas Southern University. Has the rare distinction of an LLM from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and has been a legislator in the city and state level. He wasn't the state legislator or city councilman or candidate for mayor as Willie Brown. Nothing wrong with Willie Brown. Nothing wrong with being Sam Culpepper. Nothing wrong with being Robert Churchill. However, some have found it possible to run as with Muslim names, and they're bold enough and courageous enough, and they admit to their constituency, their commitment, and their constituency have elected them and reelected them, such as Brother Imam Yusuf Salam. He's also a practicing imam. He's not one of these sit-by imams or drive-by imam. He started the masjid in Selma, Alabama, just on the basis of community development. That's what community development really should be, is developing, having our religion informed our community development. I'm honored and privileged, without words, beyond words, rather, to have him with us. And I want to announce to our audience that Blog Talk Radio, Religion Means Alive, will broadcast from the worldwide headquarters of Mosque Cares, 929 East 171st Street in Hazelcrest, Illinois, Sunday. My address will be the people of Joseph, not black folk, the people of Joseph, which includes all colors. Why Black Lives Matter. I'm not going to tell you what my topic is going to be, but I hope you'll understand if you give me, be patient with me, and come out Sunday, listen Sunday, you will hear me define those terminologies and define black and even define white in the real sense of what they mean rather than some color, a fixation that's been given to divide people and confuse people. People are cultures. They are people. They're not a race. So that's enough for what we're going to talk about Sunday. I just wanted to ask our brother to give us an opening statement. Out of his opening statement, I'm going to tease out some of the concerns of the day. Thank you, Brother Imam.
Well, let's see. Can we acknowledge your warm welcome and your etiquette and your kindness? And we need to put forward a case dealing with the national political situation, what happened in Baltimore with the recent election of Catherine Pugh, congressperson Donna Edwards, I think is her name, in Maryland, and I lost to Representative Chris Van Hollen. This courage of opioids and devastating epidemic that's carrying the country, some even suggesting without adequate proof and evidence as of this point, that Prince may have been a victim of this craze. And a collateral look should take a look at the death and murder of those eight people in a place called Pike County, Ohio. What does that mean in terms of America's cultural and civilizational life? How does it fit into the context of Yom Medin? How does it relate to the future of the sons and daughters of Adam in America, African American people, and others? These are some of our pressing concerns, and we must be sensitive to these concerns because we maintain and we advert and we allege and we stipulate that we're living in prophetic times, times that were predicted in both Bible and Al-Quran. We have to understand that. And the Imam once said, Imam Wahdi the Muhammad, the blessed Imam once said, that how do you know the Creator? How do you know Allah? How do you know God? So we can't know him directly. We can know him by his works. And today's world is full of the active intervention of Almighty God. His works are on powerful display. With that brief opening statement, Brother Imam, I now turn it over to you for cogent and acute and sharp dialogue.
I wanted to ask you about one of the first key factors that happened before we get to electoral politics. I would like to ask you about the plea of guilty and the sentencing of the third most powerful person in these United States. In fact, the one that was 9-3 for being the president of these United States. I speak of none other than Congressman, former Congressman, and former Speaker of the House, Dennis Hassert, federal judge.
Well, go ahead.
Federal judge decided against the recommendation of the United States government, decided to sentence him to 18 months in the federal penitentiary, and despite his health issues. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, let me say it's always a tragedy when a gifted human being, a talented human being, allows himself to get caught up in the legal machinery, violated, and have to be incarcerated or punished. A man from heaven being incarcerated like the everyday brothers and sisters down on earth. That's always tragic. But I like to see it within a pattern where you had an African-American political, a son of Ham, that happens to be in the Democratic Party. And he has been up against very high standards. If you look at his term, Brother Imam, we can see that many of these Republicans leaders on a state and federal level are falling victim. You have so much difficulty adjusting with this one individual, criticizing, yet there are many of the criticizers, not saying that Hastert was, but surely he represented Republican leadership. And this is not a party thing. It just so happened that the party went out of his way to obstruct, sabotage, and destroy the attempt to destroy the administration of President Barack Hussein Obama. It's rare that a public official would be sentenced more than a recommendation by the prosecutor. It's rare that a judge would override that and tack on additional time. And I would have to venture to guess that that judge was privy to some inside information about the case that may not have been exhausted publicly, at least in the eyes and ears of most of our public. So I talk very, very genuinely because, you know, I'm hesitant to whip people when they're down. But I think what I said was a fair analysis of the situation.
Yeah, and you were more than fair. I really honestly see, and you have spoken very fairly of defendants that have come before the court, and you are an absolute loyal officer of the court and been more circumspect than I've heard most practicing attorneys, and how I've watched on many TV talk shows how they just incarcerate people and have really destroyed the sons of Ham in the process before there's even a trial. We witnessed Dr. William Cosby being basically sentenced and hung prior to a trial by jury. This man pled guilty. So I think it was fair. I won't belabor the point. I thought it was unusual.
I think that if you look at the situation, there is a pattern. The creator establishes pattern when he's sending an important message to the human being. Everywhere you look, former Governor Robert McConnell, I think it is, of Virginia, before the Supreme Court on some kind of legal violation, they used him once to bash and counter the President Obama on a State of the Union night, I think. So we see this pattern everywhere. Criticizing him excessively, but on the other hand, many falling victims and not meeting the standards that they would press upon him.
Yes. Beverly, ma'am?
Yes, I'm listening, my friend.
There's a lot moving in us today, and there's many questions in our minds and our soul. I have in politics. I wonder if we can switch for a moment to the state of Imam Muhammad's community, because I was in a meeting a couple of days ago. We're not going to bring the audience in on that meeting, but I do say this. Your name had come up as being a fair, possible judicial officer in examining facts of disputes in the community. And I'm not dragging you in, but people know you to listen to the broadcast. And the question becomes whether or not this community, how does one in the community have been grieved, whether it be by financial malfeasance, or particular financial malfeasance, the conversion of properties, the allegations of conversion of properties, the personal use, the misuse of community funds. People have gone to the attorney generals of several states looking into these matters, and the Attorney General's office has been reluctant to deal with it. I'm wondering, should the community have some type of grievances body? Should it have some type of adjudication body to deal with disputes, since we are now, each community is autonomous? But does autonomy mean there's anarchy? And if it doesn't mean anarchy, what does it mean for us, members of the community, when they have grievances against our leaders, to remove those leaders, at least to bring those leaders to justice? And whether I'm barking up the right tree, and this is not legal language, this is my common language, when I say that we should even have some type of judicial body, a fairness committee or something, to look at these disputes. We seem to want to put them first. We want to throw all of them at the feet of Imam Waqti Muhammad when he was here. We threw them all at the feet of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad when he was here. And now some are even often throw them at Imam Waqti Muhammad II. I just don't think that the scripture is wrong when it says, must Jesus bear the cross alone and all the world go free? Now, we know that the cross is not referring here to any physical crucifixion, but the responsibility, cross representing the responsibilities of all the four rivers of life, the struggles that we have to establish that life. I'm just wondering whether we are a democracy, whether each citizen in this community, or certainly a select group, should be responsible for adjudicating our affairs, rather than we don't have to go to the court system and clog them up with all our so-called ecclesiastical affairs.
Well, let me say, first of all, in order to create a mechanism that's extra messier in its jurisdiction to adjudicate these problems you're talking about, there must be some leaning in of this idea of runaway autonomy. See, there's a difference between rational autonomy and some kind of collective community, where on some level we have a sense of national intergroup relationship. I've never bought this extreme idea that once the Imam passed, there shouldn't be any attempt to connect or work together harmoniously on any level. In the absence of that, whatever decisions are made are not going to be binding. They're not going to be given full faith and credit by anyone, including the people in the masjid that may oppose the decision. Something is going to have to be done first about this extreme idea of autonomy. I heard what the Imam said over years on that issue. It was a strategic position that he took. I remember being at a meeting of Southern regional imams, and I asked a pertinent, relevant question. Are we supposed to abandon the 40-year experience of the Nation of Islam, the 30-plus year experience of the Association of the Imam, and become a bunch of floating atoms in space without any group identity? Most people did not want the responsibility of trying to bring some coherence to the group. So any body that's created should be very careful, because there may not be sufficient authority to bind anyone or to enforce anything. in the absence of us resolving our problems of autonomy, the only other option is to play on our autonomy. Let the good faith believers in the masjid organize their own body and let them hear the evidence, come together and attempt to make the best judicious decision that they can make under the circumstances. I would think that most would feel now with this insane position, irrational position about autonomy, about any super masjid board beyond the masjid making decisions to decide masjid issues. It may be some individuals that want that, but you're going to get a lot of pushback from the imams and their flunkies. So they're going to plead a lack of jurisdiction.
Really, man, you've given me pool room laughter, and it's really a sad fact. But even though I laugh, I'd have to cry, because I will say this, and we're going to go on. We're going to stay here too long, but I think this is – I have told people that my position is pretty clear. If asked to adjudicate one of these matters, I would use my good office. But I would ask for a new judicial officer, a man of your stature, that know evidence and rules and laws. I'm not a man of law. I've studied and have great appreciation of law. However, I think that we got people in this community that have the skills, the temperament to adjudicate a thing. I don't think it's a good idea for an imam to be involved in it. But I do think that where we have people who happen to be an imam and also is trained in the legal profession and also trained, one brother was recommended to be as a mediator. I think we should
on an ideal level, that may be a reasonable idea. But such a process is demanding and time-consuming. And in the absence of clear investiture of judicial and decision-making powers, I don't think I want to ever get involved in these wild beast situations. Mm-hmm. It's too counterproductive. There's nobody on the national level that got the voice of authority to recommend that, to get some kind of Democratic consensus on it. And so you will again have a situation where the opposition group will take out their claws and the prayer leader will become the beast leader. And you'll go up in there in an ambush. I really believe that. I don't think I have the time, certainly not the inclination.
Yes, I appreciate that. I think so. I do think, however, that must be a discussion of this issue of autonomy. I think I'm prepared to discuss it using evidence from Imam Muhammad, reading from him of what he said, and I think it has been overly abused. So I think that that's not probably good. I'm going to move along and ask you, what do you make first of the party that you are not a member of, the party that you perhaps are opposed to, making it seem that the consolidation of Mr. Trump, as I call him, as the head of the Trump organization, Donald Trump, as some would call him, some would even call him even other names. What do you make of the fact that he now seemed to have consolidated and put locks on the nomination, and that Kasich and Mr. Cruz, Senator Cruz, that is, and Governor Kasich in the dust?
Well, let me say this. In politics, there's certain what you call terms of art. I would agree that that he's on the road to becoming, if he has not already become, the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. That's, to me, is clear. And when you're a political analyst, you do not allow personal animus against a political campaign to cloud your judgment. And I think personally that he will be the Republican nominee. But consolidation, that's a different issue altogether. Look to come with a solid situation. I don't believe it'll ever happen where one third of the Republican Party can be induced, seduced to support the candidacy of Donald Trump. It's just not going to happen. I'm listening to former candidate Bush, count me out. I saw a prominent military analyst, conservative, count me out under no circumstances. So there has not been any consolidation. There has been accumulation of delegates. And you can be the presumptive nominee and accumulate the majority of delegates. But that's a different issue, my friend, than unifying and consolidating that support. If you look at what happened on the East Coast, you study it. Ted Cruz, for instance, is a miserable performer on the East Coast. He simply was not in a competition. John Kasich has not been able to mount a consistent winning streak whatsoever. Most of those East Coast states, if not all, are going to go Democratic in the general election. They're going to go deep blue, without a doubt. So delegates were generated, but the strength of those victories in view of the woefully weak competition and the woefully weak competition and the fact that you're not going to carry those states anyway.
Okay,
tend to bring what now?
I was going, okay, I want to move now to the Democratic race, and this week I've just been outed with a lot of personal and massaged regional concerns, so I mean, well, I turned on the television and barely read the newspaper, but I do want to ask the question. It would seem that the Sanders campaign is waning, and that Ms. Hillary, Secretary Clinton is growing, and that she seemed to have a lock on the
It's not waning, brother, ma'am. Excuse me for cutting you off. Senator Sanders was resoundingly defeated this week. If he participated in every primary, it would be like, and won, it would be like Don Quixote at the windmill. Really, the race was effectively over when she won those Midwestern states and swept the night. Illinois, Ohio, Missouri, and North Carolina. After that night, it was over. People got impressed with that series of caucus state victories of Senator Sanders. But they didn't carry very many delegates. Hillary Clinton winning just in Arizona almost neutralized those gains. And when she coupled those Midwest victory with the New York victory and what happened overnight, the election in the Democratic Party is over. whether or not Senator Sanders understands that and take the appropriate action, which does not necessarily mean dropping out, but it does mean embracing the political fact that you will never be the nominee of the Democratic Party in 2016. That's going to go to Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. It's not just waning. He has been resoundingly defeated. At no time has Senator Barack Obama.
I didn't use that is an appropriate language to use. I'd like to move on now to the next campaign, which I didn't follow, so I'm not adequately prepared to ask you the question. But you mentioned two elections there in the state of Maryland, which I haven't followed, the nomination of the she's the presumptive winner of the Democratic race in Maryland. I'm using these terms because I haven't followed and don't know the results. And also you mentioned another political race in Maryland. So would you care, first of all, to refresh my mind of what has happened?
Mayor is one race that's very, very interesting. The mayoral position among African Americans started off with a mayor bang. Brother Swoops, I know you remember him.
Oh, yeah.
National notoriety, came African American mayor of Baltimore. But if you look at the situation now, Mayor Stephanie will be leaving, but I think before her there was a woman.
Yes.
Then her, and now Catherine Pugh. What is this thing where African Americans in Baltimore cannot put forward a competitive mayor leader to be chief executive of that city, that the position has consistently landed in the laps of African American women? Not saying that there's anything wrong with that, but that's a peculiar situation that I cannot explain. Now, you haven't served time as imam in Baltimore. Maybe you know certain nuances about the town that can explain that. But that's very interesting to me. Now, the second race was a young leftist progressive African-American congressperson who ran for the vacated seat of Senator Barbara McCluskey. She ran against a Caucasian mayor player in the Congress by the name of Chris Van Hollen. The African American Black Caucus did not endorse her. There was evidence in a loose way Obama was not with her, President Obama. She did get major play from the left on the cover of the Nation magazine and all of that. But she gave up her House seat to run for that Senate seat, and she took a resounding loss to Chris Van Hollen. Even though Hillary Clinton, Senator Clinton, won Maryland decisively.
Yes, I will comment on Maryland, and I think I comment when I first became resident imam in Baltimore, effectively imam of that state, representing our association. We were pretty strong at that time. And a brother told me, somebody said the brother was mentally ill, but I don't think he was. There was something to say. He said, "Brother imam, this is Maryland. Maryland is the state that has more African-American Catholics. In fact, it's the only state in the Union that, besides Louisiana, that the Catholics were given permission to missionize the African-American. And we have seen the telling effects. I would one time love for you to interview about the state of Baltimore.
very confused, not confusing, but clear to me, that it's been Mary Land. It was once Mary, the mother of Jesus, the African-American, the elite, the Murphys and the others, the Mitchells, were Mary, the mother of James. And the city has progressively grown to be Mary, the Mary Magdalene, a very confused society, not religious at all, effectively a dead church, a dead masjid. In fact, with the masjid I used to be the imam over, has been taken over by Salafist types. And the imams there are just very weak and have no real presence in the city. I think there's been a thing. Another thing that's very interesting about that city is that I am somewhat surprised by how Mayor Curry the Smokes, an Oxford graduate, a Yale graduate, a Stanford graduate, and just pretty much his presence in Baltimore is evaporating. He's now the chancellor of the University of Maryland at Baltimore, but actually was the dean of the Howard Law School, which for a man with that stature, one would have thought he would have evolved higher than that. And I'm not saying him. I'm talking about just the state of African American. To me, he should have been the president of Howard University. But anyway, I think this is a real sad state, and it tells me that we need to do a lot more work there in that state of Maryland. I didn't follow the particulars of the election, but the state is very divided. The political power, the African American there, it's just very, very, very absolutely divided, confused, and the state of our people is quite dismal. It seems that there's a future for the young lady who is the mayor, I mean, who is the state's attorney in the state. But again, it will be one rule. I don't know very much about this current lady. I haven't. And I really have kind of lost contact with my sources in Maryland.
She was a state representative during the either she was a city council person or state representative or someone in the state house. I remember her name from the Freddie Great Crisis. And if I'm not wrong, I think District Attorney Mosley, husband of city councilman, I think he may have been one of the candidates for that position. Don't hold me to it, but I think I heard his name thrown in the batch. Also, this guy McKeeson, who's one of the activists in the Black Lives Matter movement, he ran in that election and was not successful. But you had Ms. Pugh coming on the heels of a former Maryland resident, Sister Harriet Tubman, being honored as a woman on the $20 bill. So very interesting state of affairs, and it's something cooking there that I think you put your thing on it, but it may be a little bit more in the mix that I think may come out in time.
Yes, and I want to congratulate the Secretary of Treasury for putting the great Sister Harriet, the Honorable Sister Harriet Tubman on that, and that at least bodes well for the prophetic mission of the state of Maryland, and hopefully our people will repent and come back. I want to ask you a question. What do you make of the Black Lives Matter movement?
It's a good secondary backstop scenario. It must be coupled with something around the idea that black essence matter as well. The human essence contained in the black matter or the black body, that's very, very, very important. There's not enough focus on the harm and the devastation that's occurring with the essence of African-American people. I was so perturbed when a brother who works with me reported in Selma a story of a third grade or fourth grade child, which I can't bring myself to discuss the details in this interview. But it's devastating. He indicated to me other stories and narratives pertaining to the elementary school children that he's teaching every day. Almost a complete loss of human essence. So, if it's any good that's being done by Black Lives Matter, all praises due to God. But me personally, it's kind of like that incarceration thing. I prefer to lead with the emphasis on the mass incineration. And when it comes to whatever is impacting African-American people, I would rather lead with the issue of the dissolution of our essence as human beings. I think that's very important. And that essence really matters more than the harming of black flesh. I just wanted to put it in that perspective. Not to say that the injustice of undue harming, arbitrary harming, capricious harming of African-American flesh should be taken without a cry for justice. That's not what I'm advocating.
Well, let me ask you this. This is a new terminology that's been bantered about, and I'm about sick and tired of the academic world, black bodies, and you know, I just think that we're not black bodies. We are. I don't want to give away my subject, my lecture Sunday. I'm going to address this, but maybe you can give me some help. This whole black bodies and race, I mean, gender as a social construction, and Judith Butler, and all of this postmodern nonsense, in my opinion.
Really, when you look at the quasi mentally and in intellectually developed African-American elite person, there is a severe problem of a cloning syndrome. What do I mean by that? We have not had the confidence as an intelligentsia, as a body, to strike out on our own and carve out an arc or a principle, a body of knowledge that we can agree on to chart our course. That's a very daunting task. So we become clones. If the rhetoric from the dominant society is about race and body, physicality and materiality, then it's very easy for us to clone it. What happened with the Nation of Islam that was so special that an outside force came in and gave them a rudimentary body of principles that was not a result of a Caucasian cloning of our minds and soul? And when the man became a master explicator of Quran, then he had a body of knowledge that could deal with every aspect of human life. Not what this world say about race, about bodies, but what divine science and Allah has revealed about that. Most people are too intellectually lazy, brother Imam, to go and start off from scratch and build an ark of principles the way Noah was instructed to do. So that's our problem. No independent creative thinking. Look, we know from the book of revealed science that Adam is not a physical creature. there's no emphasis on race in terms of sociological classification. And it really perturbs me why people have been victimized by these artificial, unscientific classifications to go and repeat them like a parrot without any individual thinking and assessment as to how we are to look at this, those phenomena.
Let me ask you this. Why hasn't there been a Muslim intelligentsia, a Muslim African-American intelligentsia, rather than people who just become obsessive, compulsive about Arabic? And I don't want anybody to think I'm not interested in studying the Quran and Arabic. I mean, I'm currently enrolled in a course right now in Quranic Arabic. So, I mean, I'm very concerned about that. But I'm also concerned about application. I think we've gotten too obsessed whether we should roll our pants, legs up. We haven't even explicated what Imam Muhammad has given us in the worship life. But why aren't we? What is wrong with us? We have more PhDs, masters, doctorates than we've ever had.
I can answer that from what it appears to me. The intellectual information, this Quranic science, or whatever you are referring to, is not undergirded and prepared by Cobb Salim. See, the real intelligentsia in a social order, they're prepared profoundly by love for the people. An almost obsessive desire to probe the limb of the trees of knowledge, problem and probe the limb to find solutions. It's their heart, it's their affection, it's their love for the people that make them shape their information in a very practical, pragmatic, and useful way. Without that, the information is used as a show-off glitter thing to impress the following dupes, as opposed to a body of information that's being prepared, undergirded, and fueled by love to solve the problem of the people. I've seen that, and it just sometimes it looked like the man was on a lonely island when he said the problems of our people are intolerable, they're unbearable, we got to come together as an intelligentsia to work together to solve those problems. I don't know whether you remember that statement, but he made it on multiple occasions.
Not only do I remember that statement, I traveled to Atlanta, Georgia on two occasions. He made these addresses in Atlanta. That's supposed to be the black intellectual and I would even say psychological, if not economic, capital of African America, black America, whatever we want to call it, Negro America. I just think that it just doesn't seem – it seems that we have gotten – I went to the masjid then in Atlanta, and I want to talk about Atlanta masjid, and I didn't find any Imam Muhammad's material there, but I had a discussion with a young lady in the masjid, and she was discussing Michael Dyson. And I said to the sister, Michael Dyson is a lightweight. I mean, this guy's not even a proper theologian, more or less a cultural critic, and he's ashamed to the Baptist preacher's profession. I said, look, after all, I've been influenced by Vernon John, Mordecai Johnson, I named all the others, and was on Facebook the other day and had someone to say I just spoke to Virgil Alexander Wood, Reverend Dr. Virgil Alexander Wood. And I said to the person, coincidentally, Virgil Wood was my mentor. I mean, he brought me into the ministry. Those men at that time, I'm not saying now, those men at that time was talking about the race. They were influenced by Dr. Mays. They were influenced to build up our people. I even am ashamed of our ethnic group that I hardly heard any of our people doing anything other than promoting their own personal careers, including the great so-called intellectual
Mr. Coates. I guess I think it's Tylenisha, Tanisha Coates. But I just don't see any bear there, as one French intellectual said.
How can there be there when he, by his own self-admission, acknowledged the fact that as a northern urban young man, he could not get to the solid soul position of Dr. King? The truth of the matter is, there has never been a divinely blessed leader amongst us that became impactful, that was a materialist. Brother Coates is a brilliant writer, but he is a diehard materialist. Now, he may say, well, I don't believe in religion, but I do have my own system of spirituality. That may or may not be true, but he's a materialist. And there's no guidance that can come to our people that with a drain of salt from a materialist, from Karl Marx on down, is just nothing of value.
Toni Morrison has argued, and I would say rather weakly, that he is the new Jimmy Baldwin. Am I drunk to assume that he – first of all, I don't think he's a great writer. That's number one. But number two, that's another factor. I've been often love writing and eloquent writing. I think he's not that. I don't think he has an analysis at all. I think that – am I wrong in assuming that Jimmy Baldwin would have been drunk if he had written this copy? I don't see any clarity in Mr. Coates. Am I wrong to be?
That's reasonable people can differ on that. That's why I like to take an objective tack in dealing with him. Jimmy Baldwin was a man of the soul experience out of the church. And because of that, Coates cannot touch him. You go and read all of Jimmy Baldwin's books, and they were permeated with a deep-seated soul sense. That's what I'm talking about. You don't get that with Coates. Now, technically, some may say he's a good writer. I don't know. But that's beside the point. What are you communicating? And how is that? What can that communication do? Read. That's the communication in the name of your guardian Lord. So that communication uplifted mankind. So this thing about being a good writer in a vacuum with no nexus to anything or any force that can move the soul of black folks, I'm not impressed with that. He's a materialist.
I'm with you.
He shouldn't be put in the same class, in my opinion, with James Baldwin. No way.
So I agree. I think that I just don't see anything there. I just really don't. I failed to see anything. I just finished reading a book called Ghetto by Mitchell Dunier, and I was reading about even people like Horace Caton and St. Clair Drake, even though they were not religious, you saw in those men's work, Kenneth Clark, the love for our people. So I understand the secular intellectual.
They were not religious, but secular knowledge comes out of the picture if it's impactful.
Right.
So
right.
They came with valid knowledge out of the picture by, in Clark's case, studying objectively the human psyche. He was just not writing. But what you have with brothers like Coates is a bunch of subjective explication. The people you talk about were either psychological scientists or social scientists. That's different.
I agree with you. You know, the only thing I disagree with you on is that we need to be heard by more people, and that's what I'm getting. We're going to rebroadcast this and put it on Facebook, and that we must, this dialogue. You know, a brother told me, he said to me, you know, there's a picture of us Muslims. They think we don't have any intellect, we don't read any books. They would grant us that we're nice moralists and we have the right things. Okay, brother, I like what y'all doing. But, oh, you read that? You read that? And I would wonder, what do you think is the general impression of the public on us, our ability to be able to engage in the discourse of the issues of our people and even of the world?
Will you repeat that, Brother Imam? What's at this point? What was the question?
The question really was how. Well, more of the question is, I made a commentary, and then I was saying the opinion of most people I meet, they're kind of surprised when they hear our interviews and even our own discussions that we're literate. I mean, you know, most people in the general public think Muslims are illiterate. You know, they think that Malcolm was an anomaly. They didn't have a real sense of Imam Muhammad. And I would say that much of his following have not gone out and engaged these people. You know, I think there's a weakness on our part that we have not engaged people. I was wondering about your opinion about the engagement of the world of thought and putting our own renderings on the society. Have we been weak in applying what we have gotten from Imam Muhammad and al-Islam?
Certainly, and we have not penetrated, because we have not had the active metaphorical aggression of a steed racing and penetrating. We forgot that part of the holy book. Our obligation to be like that steed and to penetrate the order. And that's something that I've loved to always do as a supporter of Imam Muhammad. Get out and penetrate the order. Get out there and impact the order. Get out there and make the order understand, to make the order accommodate, and to make the order cooperate. Don't tell me it cannot happen, because I saw it happen in the very strong Alabama Bible Black Belt. It can be done. The question is, why do we overlook the clear guidance of that Quranic instruction? And I think it goes to the question of struggle and sacrifice, especially coming on the heels, where even though that surah was not in the bowl, the brothers in the Nation of Islam, as a general rule, they penetrated. I saw them in a little bit of Athens, Georgia, back in the 60s, and somehow one of them got in the loop and started impacting developments in the town, forming coalitions, working with us, living with us in the Black House. I saw that. I say this, put it this way, in and out in the Black House.
Yeah, no,
so the Nation of Islam didn't have that problem as a general rule.
I was one of them. I was one that went in the Black House at Madison, Black House in Minnesota, throughout the Midwest, integrating, not particularly what went on in the Black House. You know, things went in the Black House, there was almost a blackout. So that's also the hubris of the 60s. But we, the Nation of Islam, believed that we had a message. And it was about saving our people. It was not about an individual quest. I've slept on floors, slept in sleeping bags, and took the message to our people. I mean, I didn't throw away my snake-like training. I went on and I didn't wear sandals, but I put on a suit and tie, and I had my papers, and I went to every campus I could find. I was at the National Black Political Committee. It seems to me that there needs to be a student movement, not to learn Arabic, but a student movement to save our people. Am I wrong in assuming that that's what should happen?
Yesterday, and I got on a shirt now, given to me by my granddaughter, her and a couple other African-American sisters who are Muslims organized a core group of students. And they yesterday had on this campus a major program on Al-Islam. I was one of the presenters. That was a young, good brother who has not been enlightened in the strategies of wise conversations within the context of the West to give a beautiful strategic presentation to open up the people's ears. But nevertheless, he was a good-hearted, sincere young man. I've been knowing him since he was a little boy. And then there was his sister from Yemen, familiar somewhat with the literal expression of Al-Islam, but not a whole lot of reflection and pondering. But as we were in that meeting, I studied all the Caucasians that was there. And when I introduced myself, my titles that I put on myself, I threw out that I'm a proud Southern gentleman. And when I say it that, all the little possible bias against Al-Islam, it looked like it melted away. They saw a common person with common roots identifying with them on a basic level. And I studied them throughout the presentation. I found them very amenable to the sober explication, what we call tafsir, of Imam Muhammad. I saw that. And that gives me pause to have a little hope. I mean, give me pause to think about the possibilities that kind of open and clear communication within the context of the South, what that can really accomplish, Brother Imam.
You know, it's funny you say that, but I was on Tuesday night at a gala of mainly evangelical Christians and found the same reception. I often tell them, look, Virgil Mae Desmond was one of the best Christians I knew. She happens to be my mother. And she taught me the Bible. I have great respect for you all, and I'm from those roots. I think we are so afraid, we're terrified to identify with our Americanness, with our commonality, with our Southernness. And when you look separate and apart from people and you see them as somebody who's rejecters of faith, I don't know how you're going to be able to bond with them. I think
you have to understand, and the thing we cannot allow is for them to be able to paint us as separate and different and outside of the religious tradition of the West, which we know is the so-called Judeo-Christian ethic. Do you Muslims have to pray five times a day? Well, I don't know whether you know it or not, but Jesus instructed you not only to pray, but to fast as well.
That's
so
right.
He instructed you to fast and pray. Now, that's in the Bible. So we're under the same obligation that you under, to fast and pray. That brings about a spirit of unity and not separation. And because a lot of Muslims, we have psychologically estranged ourselves from common humanity. You have done that.
Yes. Yeah, and who should know about the commonality more than African Americans? When you sit down at the table, Thanksgiving, or other family gatherings, you have to have a commonality with your sisters and brothers. You don't go trying to act strange. You know, they still call me by my nickname now. I don't get alienated. I don't get angry. But one of my family members said, "Now, why don't you never tell us about your religion?" Well, I said, "You know, you never asked." But, you know, it's a commonality.
Yeah, that's the key. Be careful about playing into this concocted image of us being foreign, not in a nationalistic or territorial sense, but foreign to anything that's inclusive of the Judaic Christian religion in the West. We're not foreign to that.
And here's another problem. I'm going to leave it with this one. It seems that some of us are more comfortable in interfaith settings with other ethnic groups than we are being comfortable with Reverend Jones, Reverend Culpepper. I'm getting a lot of friendship requests from Christian clergy. One even left me his number, and I shared with him in common what I had in common and some of the preachers I knew. I think when we mention Reverend Dr. Vernon John, we mention Reverend Monica Johnson, we're bringing a commonality that we have come from Christian roots. We're not there to put down Dr. Vivian. We're not put those people down. We're not put down great Christians who sacrificed for us. Why is it that some Muslims in our community are more comfortable setting an interfaith gathering with other ethnic groups but can't sit down with Reverend Jones or Reverend Smith, Reverend Brown? Or Sister Sadie?
Irvin Poole, Brother Ma'am, was a minister. Just because Wally Poole, I think that's the name of Elijah's father, and his son Elijah became so-called Muslims. There was no iron curtain placed between them and their ancestor. My daddy was a preacher. My granddaddy was a preacher. Just because I took Shahada does not mean that that essence does not run through my blood. So we grew out, my point, of the Christian experience. Allah in his wisdom allowed that to be our base and foundation of development. So now why should we go and separate in spirit from our foundation? I can't see it. We ought to be proud of that foundation. We ought to be happy about that foundation. We ought to be loving and compassionate toward that foundation. But at the same time, being able to distinguish very clearly the difference between the roof, and the foundation. Imam Muhammad went way beyond Irvin Poole, his ministerial ancestor. But nevertheless, paradoxically, he still had Irvin Poole in his soul. He had his very DNA in his soul. That's very important. What am I saying? Our existence is a continuance of all that came before in terms of our beautiful religious experience in America. But war must continue to run. And one of the fears I have about our Christian African American brothers is that the waters are becoming stagnant. They have not produced a running warrior giant in the nation since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Brother, ma'am, I don't care how we slice it. That's a natural fact.
Well,
before
him, I don't have any argument. I don't have an argument to counteract that one. It is a fact. Because how we know? We would have seen some effective changes among our people.
We would have had a great reformer. There should have been a 1-2 punch of reformation coming out of the church. Dr. King reforming the church to remove some of the docility and the passivity in the face of abject Jim Crowism and de jure segregation. But then a second reformer coming, dealing with the internal problems that we have, as a people, in a strategic utilization of the Bible and our Christian roots to address those problems. Where is the person who's done that on a big level? Name that person.
It hasn't. It hasn't. And I tell you something, I'm praying that they will get that. I think once this community is revived, I believe that the Christians will then, God will bless them to get one. But we first got to be reformed and revived.
Go ahead.
I think the tragedy of African American Muslim life, and this, I'm going to end it with this, I don't want to hold you. I think the tragedy of African American Muslim life has been we have gone to the church of the 50s that is highly spiritual, worried about the next life, ritualistic, and strongly focused. Whereas the new African American church that is really growing, not the mainstream ones, are basically like the temple of Islam. They're talking practical. They're no longer preaching. They have men's group. They have women's group. They're teaching what they call the prosperity teaching. And now we have gone off into a hole somewhere, and some would argue a rabbit hole at that, of no return. And we've got been absent from the society. So my whip is really on the African American Muslim, particularly its leadership, who give stale khutbahs, who don't fire people up to even open up halal businesses, don't talk about hiring our men. Man Muhammad, when he was in Atlanta in 1978, called for our priorities to be educated, secondly, create jobs for men who want to be head of also. I mean, we have daughters looking for husbands. We don't have men. We have had a mass incineration. We talk about mass incarceration. Many of the people who've been incarcerated need to be incarcerated. I don't certainly don't want them in my neighborhood. And I think that just as there's been need to be a reform in the African American church, the African American mosque, particularly the ones under Imam Muhammad, need to be reformed so it will come in alliance with Imam Muhammad, and therefore we can influence the African American Christians to come back to their roots and evolve to the Dr. King and beyond route.
Well, we had it. I'm gonna say this, and we can go. If you look at the world of sports, the first time a championship team win, they're not taken as serious as when they have a repeat. Back-to-back champions. I can't think of a time in the history of African-American leadership where there were back-to-back mega performers, reformers, like in the case of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and his son. Not only was there a repeat of excellence, the second one excelled the first one. Now, the Nation of Islam had its reformer, and no other is coming, but we rejected him, did not support him, did not apply him. Now, you go back, and I'm going to bring this to a close. Ted Douglas, no repeat. Gabriel Prosser, no repeat. Nat Turner, no repeat. Boog T. Washington, no repeat. W. B. Du Bois, no repeat. Marcus Garvey, no repeat. Nobel Lee, no repeat. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., no repeat. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, a super repeat. A champion human being in the form of his son. Any intelligent people need to ask the question, if Allah is the author and designer of affairs, why is it only in that unique instance that we have repeat of mega leadership? If we understand that, then we understand the solution to our problem of identity and the precise classification of what our destiny should be. That's something that's very important.
Brother Ma'am, you have spoken most eloquently and most poignantly state of our ethnic group, the state of our religious community, and where the world must go, as I see it, in developing a new Al-Islam, a new Africa, and a new America. We're looking forward to
seeing. All I can say, my brother, I appreciate it. And you keep the faith. But while we're keeping the faith, let us also keep the faith in the human being that's object to some of our constructive critique. Because there's nothing that we say on this show. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. But certainly, in my context, there's nothing malicious. But people have a right to engage in constructive criticism. Muslim sharpens steel like steel sharpens steel. Brother Imam, thank you for the forum. We pray
and
God
thank
bless
you,
you
my
for
brother,
your
and,
sacrifice.
And thank you for your sacrifice, and thank you for the great work you're doing. We'll see you next week on Religion Means Alive, and we'll see you all in Chicago, that is, in Hazelcrest, East Hazelcrest, Illinois. We, God willing, we'll be there at 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time for the mosque's first Sunday. Our address will be the People of Joseph, making Black Lives Matter. Those of you who don't like the term Black Lives, well, you need to come and hear me define it, and you'll know that I'm talking somewhat differently than the Black Lives Matter movement, but I am using it perhaps to attract them to a discussion. And I hope people from Black Lives know that I believe that all lives matter, but certainly the African-American life matter in part of the human content. But just don't prejudge me. Just come out Sunday and hear me and let's engage me. I'm going to be open for questions and challenges and debates all at the Bosque's headquarters on Sunday, May 1st. May Day now. Y'all remember May Day? It's a May Day call. Peace be on our noble and honorable listeners. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive.